The Venturi's Voice podcast brings together some of technology's brightest minds to discuss all things leadership, technology, and staffing. Keep the conversation going in the Venturi's Voice Slack group and have the opportunity to meet some of our amazing guests. You can download Venturi's Voice via iTunes or via the Venturi Group website at venturi-group.com. Today's guest is Morgan Kraft, the CTO at Hickory. Yeah, appreciate you doing this anyway. Always difficult these days to get a schedule booked in. Everyone's so damn busy. You'd think that, you know, with the advantages of technology and being able to automate tasks in our lives now, that we'd be able to free up a bit more time. But I think the opposite seems to be happening.
Right. Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, I know so many people that have like these virtual assistants, right, that just schedule everything, and it's like a nightmare to try and like coordinate everybody's schedule for things.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, thanks for taking the time with that in mind. And I know you guys are doing some pretty cool things at the moment, and obviously in a hectic phase of growth, I can imagine, over at Hickory. I mean, you know, my background is in startups as well, so I can only imagine just how crazy things are all the time. I don't know whether it's got to the point where you have beds in the office yet. Might be that soon.
No. We got a long couch, a really long couch. I can sleep too.
Yeah, I think that's hopefully not the last resort. Although I do hear that real estate is quite expensive in New York, so it might save you a few dollars or something.
Yeah. Well, I'm up in New Jersey, so it's you know, it's like a 40-minute train ride for me. So like I commute in and out every day.
Right. Yeah, you got the U.S. Open up there this week, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
That's cool. I'm a huge golf fan, so I'm gonna be watching that from my armchair this weekend. Yeah, man. Well, I mean, it seems like New York, just in general, there's some really, really compelling startups coming out of there. You know, traditionally, I think what I've seen is it seems to be a lot in the ad tech space.
Yep.
That's kind of predominantly been the theme over there. But, you know, you guys are working on something different. I've had a few other people on the podcast and, you know, just through my network that I know that are building some really interesting things out in New York. It's not surprising that New York's, you know, really producing some, you know, some great startups. It's just, I think, maybe surprising that, you know, why it seems like it's only been relatively new that we're kind of, you know, they're getting the attention. You know, predominantly it was obviously over in California and such. Do you reckon is there any reason why you think that you know, they've had a little bit of a lag to get on board with things?
Yeah, I think you know, part of it is that the venture capital industry has really picked up in New York in the last probably 5 to 10 years. Obviously, Silicon Valley, right? They have like this, you know, the Silicon Road where all the VCs are, and you know, in New York City, it's now happening where there's a lot more angels, there's a lot more pre-seed funds, so you know, there's just a lot more capital to deploy coming out of the East Coast now, and so even with Boston, right? You know, there's just a lot more venture capital kind of coming forward now to kind of fund these startups. So I think we're starting to see a lot more growth for this industry and just the talent and the investments that are being made. So you have like Flatiron and a lot of these sort of Code Academy schools also in New York City kind of building up the engineering supply, right? So we're getting a lot more talent also coming into the pool to kind of help, you know, staff these startups as they kind of grow. So sort of the New York City tech scene is really growing in a lot of different ways. And I think that's really starting to contribute to sort of the explosive growth we're seeing in sort of the New York startup scene.
Do you think that, you know, to that point, it's interesting that do you think that the talent itself kind of drives, you know, the presence of these companies? Because, you know, scarcity of talent obviously means that it's very, very difficult, especially on a startup budget. You know, to really build our team. So do you think that that's almost the thing that needed to happen first, even potentially even before, you know, the kind of VC money was more accessible?
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, you always have some people transitioning out of sort of, you know, finance. So I know some of my colleagues even, right, they, you know, they they went to Wharton, worked at a bank for a while, and they're like, this is not what I want to do. And so they sort of, you know, kind of went to one of these Code Academy type of programs. So now they're an engineer, and now they're like, you know, they're willing to not necessarily take their 200K, you know, salary from some investment bank, right? And they're willing to work on a leaner budget, right? And sort of, but, you know, own something and kind of grow and build products and do something different, right? So I think that, you know, that also sort of helps position people to go into this market.
Definitely. So what was your kind of process then to get into the point where you are now, you know, co-founder of a startup? What was kind of your, what was your steps? Have you always been kind of relatively native to the New York area?
Yeah, so I went to school in Ohio at the Ohio State University, and I graduated and then moved to New York City with my girlfriend from college at the time. And but I had a much more traditional path, right? I studied computer science in college and sort of came out of university sort of already building websites on the side, doing some freelance work. So I started kind of doing PHP and MySQL, and I was doing Flash ActionScript at the time because JavaScript was kind of garbage still in the browser. And I kind of worked my way up through like the engineering ranks as sort of an independent contributor. So I joined a real estate company called ForSaleByOwner.com early on in my career, and sort of just worked my way up through the engineering ranks, you know, becoming a lead developer, eventually managing a team of engineers. Always sort of had a hand in product. I worked in a lot of different industries. Like you said, in New York City, that's kind of the upside is, you know, there's real estate, there's finance, there's a lot of agencies. So I spent some time at one of these large New York City agencies called 360i, which is now owned by Dentsu. Then they're like a large holding company for a bunch of agencies. And so like I worked on the Marvel website for the Iron Man 2 launch. So, you know, I worked on Coca-Cola's Facebook page for a while for like the PHP app. And so, you know, I had a traditional growth path through that. I did a lot of product at an ad tech company. So, you know, and then I got the chance to join this startup called Hickory. They'd come out of Y Combinator. They needed a CTO. So I joined the company probably 3 years ago and sort of, you know, now sort of running product engineering. You know, I do sales, I do marketing. I wear a lot of hats at the startups. So just a lot going on.
Well, that's the fun bit about it though. You know, from my perspective anyway, we're wearing a lot of hats. So they came out Y Combinator. Were you kind of involved in the interviewing process over there at YC, or did you come in just after that?
I came in after the Y Combinator. So the interviewing process was fun, and the Brian, the CEO, has a lot of stories about their time at Y Combinator. But, you know, they were in San Francisco for that, and then they got their seed round right at the end of demo day. Basically, they had a term sheet, and, you know, they ended up moving back to New York City to actually run the company and grow it. And at the time, the CTO that was sort of the co-founder, he had to actually walk away for some personal reasons. And so then I sort of came in to basically take over and kind of, you know, build out product engineering for the company.
Has it been, I mean, obviously, you know, I think if you ever can be prepared to get involved in the startup at this stage, it seems like you've been quite well equipped just with the kind of versatility of the companies that you've worked for in the past. But even with that said, has it been the most different experience to this point in your career, getting involved with a startup like this?
Yeah, so I was fortunate that I had previously had joined another startup called YCharts, and I was the first engineer. A previous colleague of mine had founded the company and raised a seed round. So I was really lucky to have been the first engineer there at that company and sort of saw sort of how do you structure and run a seed company. You know, one of the key takeaways from that experience was how lean we kept the team early on. So early on, it was myself, the CTO, and the CEO for like the first year. And I was really just sort of rebuilding the product, starting to get like an actual, you know, sales funnel in place, getting credit card subscriptions in place before we really started ramping up hiring. And so that was, you know, a good background for me in joining this company and sort of being like, look, you know, we only have $2 million, so we got to make this $2 million last. And so really being lean early on, and it's really easy to kind of have a high burn. And, you know, before you know it, you blow through all your money in 18 months, and then you're trying to raise yet another round of funding. And, you know, and I can go into some of the details around funding, but like the way funding works now with VCs, it's constantly changing and evolving. So, you know, what pre-seed and seed and Series A look like, you know, even 2-3 years ago has really changed to, you know, today. So, you know, pre-seeds and seeds are now like $1 million, where, you know, a while ago they were, you know, 500K was like a pre-seed, or 250K would be a pre-seed. And now it's like, oh, I got $1 million in a pre-seed. So,
yeah, it's crazy how much it's changed. And now you're seeing like these other platforms as well. Like, is it OPO? I don't know if you're familiar with that, like online public offerings and different crowdfunding platforms. Actually, the Start Engine, if you're familiar with them, we were running this OPO. They were actually, he had an incubator before that, and we were actually funded by him, my first startup. So,
oh wow,
yeah. So that was, but like, he's doing some crazy things. The whole funding cycle, I think it's fantastic and it's fascinating. You know, it's almost becoming, I don't know if the easy is the word, to raise money, but maybe it is. And I think that's a fantastic thing for entrepreneurship. But I still think that there's still a lot of dumb money in the ranks, and
yeah.
I think there's a lot of following trends, and I don't know, maybe that's the right way to go about things, but there's a lot of technology maybe that's floating about that's kind of unproven, if you like, that seems to be getting a ton of attention. Do you kind of have a take on that at the moment in the current climate that we're in? Because there's all these like fascinating techs and automations and blockchains and all the rest of it that are coming up don't necessarily have like the practicality, but in its fullest. But it seems to, you throw some buzzwords out there and you can raise money these days.
Yeah, I think, you know, what you can see in the seed and the pre-seed is definitely there's a lot more exploration and sort of investments and maybe first-time entrepreneurs that may not have a proven track record, but maybe they have a solid idea, and really the point, right, of a pre-seed round is really to kind of, you know, here are the questions we're going to try and answer in this, you know, sprint of our product life cycle, right? Like, you know, can we acquire customers? You know, do they want this product? Can we prime the market? What's the marketing going to look like? And so those are typically the questions you're going to try and answer in the seed or the pre-seed. And so there's these different stages as you go from pre-seed to seed. You know, you have to, like I said, answer those questions. Where it gets challenging, right, is in the Series A, because a lot of the goalpost for a Series A has moved. And so you just can't roll up into investors and be like, hey, I want to raise $5 million in a Series A, right? They want a lot of revenue. They want to make sure you have a proven sales process. And so the goalpost for Series A has been moved. And so now what you start to see is like you have these startups that can come in. They can raise money really easily in the seed pre-seed round, but then they get the seed and then they don't have enough, you know, momentum to get the A. And then they're sort of swirling in this seed round, and maybe they get a bridge and then they can get another bridge. But at some point, you know, the investors cut them off and they're like, look, you're not getting closer to the A. Like, we can't keep giving you money. Like, it's done. So I think that's sort of one of the changes we're starting to see in this market is like, you know, getting the A is a lot harder now, but getting sort of this, you know, the seed capital is a little bit easier. But at the same time, it's like you got to really execute to get that A. And so that's, I think, where we're starting to see sort of a change in the market. And obviously, the companies that don't have a solid team or a solid tech or truly understand their market or have real customers, right, they're not going to get to the A, you know, no matter how much seed money you get them. I mean, I could be wrong. I mean, there's obviously unicorns in the mix, but you know, I think that's sort of what we're starting to see in the market.
Yeah. I think it's proof. Yeah. Well, it all leads down to kind of proof of concept and actually execution on being able to actually monetize, right? I think is something that's changed. We had a bit of a boom where, you know, there was some crazy valuations being thrown around for companies that, you know, didn't have a solid, you know, way to monetize their product. They just didn't. So I think that, you know, that's probably a lot to do with this kind of shift in attitude that you're speaking of now. You know, talking about Hickory as well, you know, fascinating product. You know, it's, you know, kind of in the ed tech space. You know, what was the, you know, drawing point for you to want to get involved, you know, just about from the product side? You know, you're obviously a product focused guy. What in particular was it about this model that you got you particularly excited?
Yeah, so for me in college, I actually kind of studied computer science and cognitive psychology. I sort of had an interest early on in going to AI. And I sort of fell into sort of this internet software piece, right, and kind of moved forward into it. But, you know, I always had a fascination with sort of memory and learning and those sorts of aspects of cognitive psychology. And I was working at an ad tech company, right? You know, doing basically making ROI on ads for, you know, large companies like Microsoft. And, you know, it was interesting to see Facebook ads at scale and how everything operates behind the scenes from fraud and whatnot. But, you know, it was like, I'm not really moving the needle for the world, right? And so when Hickory came along and they were like, look, we're looking to change the way people learn, you know, and sort of the pitch being, right, like, we're doing the same learning we've been doing for the last 150 years, right? We make these textbooks. We're just trying to put them on iPads now. Like, we have all these amazing devices, right? But, like, we're still trying to do everything the same way, which is take a PDF file and just put it on the iPad, right? And that's our new way of learning. And I think the challenge was, like, let's sort of figure out, like, what are better learning methodologies. And a lot of the inspiration came from, you know, Duolingo and Google's Primer, where everything's sort of card-based learning. And the really incredible thing about card-based learning is that you can capture the data around the cards. So instead of giving someone a 100-page PDF and saying, go read it, and maybe at the end you'll answer some questions, you can actually break up all that information and put them on the cards, and then you can sort of start to measure and collect data around the interaction. So time spent looking at the card, you know, we actually ask other things about your interactions with the cards. We might ask if the content's relevant, or how is the content structured? Is it easy, medium, or hard? And then we have cards that are different types of exercises, so we can do multiple choice, we can do like short answer or Benjamin Franklin, as we call them. We actually have other types of interactions as well, based on sort of what type of learning the learners are trying to complete. So from all that card data, we're actually then able to use that data to try and create some machine learning algorithms to help basically improve your ability to basically creating personalized learning tracks, because then we can kind of figure out, like, when should this content come back to you for you to review it? Because we obviously want to make sure that you're remembering the information. There's a lot of research by Ebbinghaus in the, I think it's the 60s, and it was all around sort of how quickly do you forget things? And, you know, he found that, like, within 3 days, you forget 90% of the information you've learned. And so that's sort of where we're focused on, is, you know, figuring out how do we actually improve your retention, and how do we think about new modalities for actually learning information?
Interesting. I think it's fascinating. I'm a huge kind of advocate, and we've talked about it on the show quite a bit, about, I suppose we've always approached it from the traditional education perspective. This is obviously just learning for people who are employed and such, but the whole education model, I think it's the most prime thing, the most prime industry I can see for disruption. I mean, it just has to be. I mean, we're already kind of seeing that on the tech scene. You know, people are able to learn, you know, to a professional level, skills online now. So, you know, the whole education model and that way of learning is always been kind of one dimensional, and we've always assumed that people who excel in this particular model, you know, people who excel in this kind of structured, institutionalized way of learning are the smartest people, you know, in the room, based on the way that we've always, you know, kind of educated people for a long time now. And I just think that everyone learns in different ways. And I think we have to start looking at this space very seriously and providing different options, like what you guys are building over at Hickory. And I think, even from the institutional perspective of education, that needs to be really looked at as well and considered, especially with online now and the access to information that we do have. And the expense, you know, it's the only kind of area education, formal education, where, you know, the quality of the product, or in this instance, you know, the degree or the diploma is being diluted, but yet the price continues to be inflated. That goes against their all kind of price and economic principles. So there has to be some give at some point. And I think it's certainly a space, and I think you guys are really well positioned in that space, you know, to be able to, you know, do levels of disruption and at least start making people think differently about how they learn. Because I think learning has always been something that people just say, oh, you need to go and learn this. But actually, there's a massive skill to on how you should actually learn. And I think that, you know, companies like yours are really kind of driving that message home by the sounds of it.
Yeah. And I think to add to that, right, it's, you know, when you think about learning, it's sort of like, you know, essentially you're acquiring the information, right, and having it in your memory, right? But really what starts that also come part of that is, right, how do you apply it? And sort of, and that's something we've also sort of been focused on is, because, you know, we're not just an ed tech platform. Our real vertical that we focus on is sort of corporate training. So, you know, one of our things was, right, we're not going to go try and sell the schools. There's so many companies already trying to do that. And so we sort of started to look at the corporate training market and being like, look, there's a lot of professional development that needs to happen, right? So people will graduate from university and they get a job, and then that company, right, they have their own sort of internal knowledge, right, that needs to be sort of distilled and distributed onto the team. And so that's where we really start to shine, is not only are we going to allow these individuals to learn and acquire this new information, but we're also going to help them in acquiring this information for how they apply it then for, you know, their organization in terms of how do they operate, you know, and which is like the other side to it, right? It's like just learning and being able to, like, you know, spit out some information that you memorized, right? That's not enough. It's how do you apply that information in a critical thinking manner so that you can sort of really address and apply the information. And so that's, sorry, that's the other piece to it, is that like figuring out how do we help them also apply the information.
I think it's fantastic. Yeah. I mean, as you were explaining then, I'm thinking about numerous examples, you know, of experiences I've been in where something like this would have been a breath of fresh air, quite frankly.
Yeah, because it's easy for people to be, you know, to say something like, whoa, I'll just Google it. Like, I don't need to know it. I can just Google it. And it's sort of like, yeah, but, you know, you can go Google it, but you're going to Google it and maybe get an answer to something. But it's like, how does that actually help you critically think about how something needs to get applied? And maybe there's other pieces of information and context that you need that you're not going to get from a Google search, right? So that's the other side to it, is like creating a curriculum, right, that kind of encapsulates all the necessary pieces that allows you to create a framework for how you apply your knowledge, is also critical to the process of learning.
Agreed. Yeah, agreed. I think it's really well put. It's weird, isn't it, the reluctancy that people tend to have when you leave education, go into the workplace. I think maybe it's because you kind of do learn as you go without learning, I suppose, when you're in the workplace. But whenever it comes to training, there's a massive reluctance in the workplace to sit down and take the time to actually learn stuff. And obviously that's inevitably to do with how busy we are and all the rest of it. But it's weird, isn't it? But I think back and I think every time we've had to roll something out, like we just had, obviously in Europe, and I'm sure maybe you guys are aware of it as well, even though I know it's not implemented with, you know, the general data protection regulation.
Yeah, GDPR.
Yeah. So we just had like a huge, you know, it's been the topic of discussion for the last sort of 12 to 18 months. And, you know, we kind of invested in doing like company-wide training. And, you know, even something like that, where it's literally, it's an hour out of your day where you need to kind of sit down. And, you know, if you take the time to learn it, you know, any questions that you might get from people about how they're handling it, you should be able to answer sufficiently to a decent level. So it obviously saves other people a lot of time, you know, and I was, unfortunately, I suppose, part of the kind of team that we put together to kind of manage the whole GDPR process. And, you know, we did this training to, you know, obviously better prepare ourselves, but also help to kind of educate the company wide about these regulations so they can feel confident answering any question that, that they might get from, you know, clients or whatever. And yeah, no one, it was kind of like just get through it, just to pass it or do whatever, you know, no one really properly learned it. And then it's hilarious because then I'm on this team and as soon as we get a message from anyone, they immediately email it over to someone else who's on the GDPR team to ask them what they should do. And it's like, well, we spent thousands of pounds here trying to educate people on how, and everyone's first action is it's like a, you know, it's like a hot coal in your hand. You just toss it over to the next guy. And I find that it's really strange that that seems to be a constant. And I know that's probably maybe a cynical way. I'm sure there's a lot of people who don't do this, of course, before anyone starts emailing me and saying, I can't believe you said that. But I think it's been consistent from what I've seen in the workplace that there just is that reluctancy to kind of educate yourselves in this way. So, yeah, I mean, it needs something like Hickory to be able to look at things differently. And I think retention, you know, might very well be the answer to at least, you know, at least doing a better job with that regard.
Yeah, I mean, I would just say, right, it's not their fault. I mean, I'm like, they're biologically hardwired to forget in 3 days unless they're actually putting in the effort, right, to try to retain the information. And then back to what I say that Hickory does, right, is that since we're all card-based learning, we will bring back the cards over time for you to review so that as you come, basically every day inside of Hickory, we have scheduled follow-up reviews of card information for you to come in and look at. It's typically 3 to 5 minutes with the intention, right, of being like, you just were supposedly learned this information 2 days ago. We're now resurfacing this information again for you to review so that we can basically help sort of create a different sort of forgetfulness curve that, you know, isn't your standard 3 day, you know, because that's just how we operate. Like, that's just how our brains work. So, you know, I think that's, you know, it's sort of like that's the intention, right? Is that like we know people do this. It's just human nature. So, like, here is the technology we're building to try to sort of augment and, you know, ensure that we're retaining the information we're, you know, trying to learn.
It's really interesting subject. I find it fascinating. I've definitely brought it up a number of times. For you as a learner, did it kind of resonate with you as well to the same extent when you looked at it? Was it something even before Hickory that, you know, you were kind of conscious of and conscious of the way that you learned and thought that this might be a great project to be able to kind of explore that a little bit further?
Yeah, you know, actually, I hadn't heard of Ebbinghaus, and even my studies in a university, I don't think I was ever in a class that talked about Ebbinghaus. You know, we did some things with sort of short-term and working memory, right? There's this thing they talk about, you know, you can hold 7 pieces of information in sort of a working area in your cognitive cycle, whether that's visual or spatial or whatnot. You know, but I hadn't heard of Ebbinghaus until I started talking to Hickory, and they were like giving me sort of some of the background and the research for how they came to this. And I was like, oh no, this makes a lot of sense. Like, this is really cool what you guys are trying to build here.
Yeah, I agree. It's fascinating. And the tech side of it as well. Do you think that, is there anything in particular on the tech side that you think has been kind of pivotal in helping companies like Hickory and other ed tech platforms really better their service? Is there something specifically that you think's really helped advance the product?
Yeah. I mean, like, we're not doing anything crazy, right? We're, our stack's pretty typical. We're Django Python in the back end, and we're using React and Redux on the front. You know, the real interesting thing for myself is, you know, I've had a lot of background with AWS. A lot of my organizations I've been at previously had larger systems running on Amazon. And at Hickory, I inherited a Heroku stack, which made sense because there was no DevOps team. And like I said, we're pretty lean. And a lot of the engineers or a lot of my colleagues, right, they don't have an AWS background. And so, you know, Heroku really enabled us to move quickly and kind of deploy and scale really easily without having to have any sort of DevOps or AWS background, which has been great. But man, you pay for that. Heroku, obviously, right? It's like a 4 or 5x, you know, fee on everything you do, whether it's your database, your servers, everything. It's so much more expensive. And, you know, so I caution anyone that's looking to build a startup. It's and you're being told like Heroku is amazing. You can get off the ground. It's like, that's totally true. You can totally get off the ground really quickly and not have to worry about it and spend money on DevOps. But as you really begin to grow and scale, you know, they're gonna basically charge you a lot of money. So there's like a pro and a con to it. So you can move a lot quicker with Heroku, but at the same time, it's like you're gonna pay for it. And that's even now one of the things we're looking to do is I'm looking to move us off of Heroku and into AWS because it's just getting too expensive at this point.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Yeah, that is really interesting. Does that mean though that then you have to look at you know, personnel budget as well?
Kinda. It's, you know, at some point I'm probably gonna need someone to help maybe run the AWS. The other side is like, you know, I'm a mindset. I like to mentor people. That's actually one of my strong skill sets. So it's more or less I'm now investing more into my colleagues, right? Being like, you know, everybody's going to start to get an AWS DevOps background, and I think it's great for everybody, right? Because that's something that I had the ability to pick up along my travels, working for different companies, and kind of getting more exposure to DevOps through those. And I'm like, and I think it's good for everybody else to kind of pick that up as well. So, you know, it's more or less sort of mentoring. And once again, right, I'm building the learning and training curriculum, right, to kind of, you know, define how, this is how we operate day to day. So, you know, we have a lot of enterprise customers that, you know, part of the enterprise contracts that we have with them for the security audits requires me to kind of hand over sort of our documentation about how we operate because they want to make sure, right, that we don't crash or we don't have issues. And if we do, like, how do we respond to them? And so, you know, we have a full flight of run books and sort of operating manuals about how do we operate. And I think that's, you know, another thing that gets sort of, you know, is not focused so much, right, in some of these engineering. Everyone wants to talk about product engineering and MVPs and being lean. And I'm like, and no one talks about, like, how do you operate your engineering organization to you know, ensure success from like, a day-to-day support piece.
Yeah, I agree. It's massively overlooked, probably because a lot of people don't want to do it. You know, I mean, that's the bottom line. You know, people want to get their head stuck into some code instead of talking about that. And maybe as well, there's an ignorance there as well about how, you know, what level of skill you need to actually execute on something like that as well.
Yeah, I think it's you know, being in an organization that sort of had that in place, so. I was at a Bizarre Voice previously on sort of a kind of this intense front end team. And there was a bunch of ex Air Force people on it. And they would run like basically what they call green flag drills where it'd be attacker and defenders. So attackers would basically blow up staging in various ways and the defenders would have to troubleshoot and fix. And so it was sort of a role play slash training exercise. But, you know, it really put into me this sense of discipline and rigor around like, how do you operate? And, you know, and I do some startup advising on the side and a friend of mine, you know, he was, you know, we were talking and I was like, well, how do you operate? What's your support? And I could just tell like his whole mood changed, right? He kind of like let out this exasperation, you know, of being like, man, it's a mess. Like I got, you know, the account people are yelling at me every day. I had to pull engineers. We're trying to fix these bugs and like the engineers, like some of them want to quit and like, you know, and it just is clear to me. I'm like, dude, you can't operate like that. Like, that's no way to operate an engineering and a product organization. Like, you know, like, people get burnt out, they're going to quit, you're going to lose momentum. Like, you could even lose your customers, right? Because they're tired of, like, the constant firefighting that you're doing, you know, and it shows, they can tell. So, you know, I think there's a lot to that piece, and sort of having been at an organization where that's, like, paramount to them, because Bizarre Voice is a publicly traded company. So they're, you know, they're no joke. Like, they mess up, like, it's going to affect their stock price.
I'm conscious on time here, Morgan, as well, so I don't want to keep you too much longer, mate. But, you know, to kind of close it out as well, you know, as you guys continue to grow and scale, do you start to set, you know, expectations upon yourself or on the company? You know, how do you kind of set goals now, I suppose, moving forward? What's your kind of way of doing it?
Yeah, so it's kind of changing for me, and we're still a small team, so just, you know, take what you can from it, I guess. Like, I'm not really doing OKRs at this point because we're kind of small still. And I know some people are big fans of it. I recently finished Radical Candor, which is a really great book, and even the author sort of talks about, like, OKRs are kind of an issue in terms of you're looking back and trying to fix problems and, like, tell people performance, and, like, really it should be a weekly thing, right? So it's more about, like, engaging and having weekly check-ins with people, sort of checking in on, like, are they getting what they need for growth in their careers, making sure that you're giving them, you know, effective feedback constantly every week instead of, like, once every quarter, right, at the end of the quarter and, like, a performance review. So, you know, it's sort of like how I kind of help, you know, progress people and mentor them, is sort of make sure it's more of a week to week check-in type of measurement. The other big thing we do is we do a weekly scorecard meeting where it's basic, right? It's just a spreadsheet, but we track a lot of numbers in it. Sort of, we have a section on engagement. So just sort of like what's happening with the software, what's the adoption, you know, some of the things we track, right, are number of cards created, you know, number of users completing lessons. So, you know, a whole gambit of just data, right? And it's sort of like, what are we doing in product, right, to drive those numbers forward as an organization? And inside of that also, we have metrics around sales and marketing as well. So it's a team effort, right? So we all get in a conference room because we're still small enough to do this. And we have sort of this scorecard meeting where everybody sees all the metrics and the health of the business. I mean, we even have our financials in there. So everybody knows how much cash is on hand, how much revenue is coming in. So that's been really just great for everybody, right? Because, you know, it's sort of when people interview with us, I'm sort of like, you know, this is like startup bootcamp, because, like, we're really transparent, and you see how marketing works, you see how sales works, you see how the finances are ran for the company week to week. So you'll learn a lot. So, you know, from that side, I think those are the two really big things we do, is it's sort of week to week measuring. And, you know, and like my whole thing is, like, you know, I like to mentor and grow people. And so, you know, it's part of that is, you know, making sure that I'm constantly trying to figure out, like, what projects are going to be best for you, on what you want to focus on in your career and where you're looking to go. So, you know, I think those are the two main things that we focus on.
Awesome, mate. Well, it's been really cool talking with you, Morgan. So thank you so much for taking the time, mate. Really appreciate it.
No, thank you for having me. I appreciate it as well. I love doing this. This is great.
Yeah, appreciate it. I really enjoyed the chat. Thanks for listening to the show. I look forward to hearing everyone's thoughts on this episode over on the Venturi's Voice Slack group. See you next time.